welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. Don't forget, folks. Every time that the government is taxing you, the majority of all that tax is going to defraud you. It's actually being spent on things they have no authority to spend. And we also have Tammy Young back with us as the, I'll just say, a champion of the Constitution that we're nurturing for the state of Wyoming. Who knows? There may be a governorship and even more for you as you aspire to be the champion of the Constitution, because
I don't know about governor.
Sometimes we can't avoid leadership. Now we've advanced as a society to recognize that anybody that's capable of doing the job should be allowed to do the job, especially if they fulfill the letter and the spirit of the intent of the job. And if they're capable of doing that, then absolutely. I've never been one to not hire somebody that was capable of doing the job. And very rarely, it's not that it doesn't happen, but very rarely, you know, when you interview people, if you do a good vetting, then there's a less likelihood that that person becomes problematic when they work for you. Right. Yeah. And so the only benefit I had is the fact that we required very high level of access to classified information. So when we had to vet individuals, we had to do an initial vetting. Could these people be cleared? In other words, hiring somebody that had, you know, that did gambling and or was involved in domestic abuse or what have you, they just, sorry, we can't even go there because they already have problems, if that makes sense. And so I actually used to brag about living and working and rubbing elbows with the cream of the crop in American society, because once there was a time where the people that had clearances had to live their life above reproach. Over time, all of a sudden, when the don't ask, don't tell, the sexual orientations went out the window, and then everything else had to go out the window, because, shoot, if you could be homosexual, then you could, and you know, because these were the standards. You couldn't have those types of things where you could be exploited. If there was anything in your closet, gambling, drugs, alcohol, any type of abuse or things like that, then they looked at that as problematic because it's things that could be exploited. This is why there were these real hard laws that required this type of lifestyle, period. And so as those things started changing, then the standards for holding classified started going out the window. But anyway, long story short, because what we're talking about now in the Constitution, because we're still covering the Constitution. What we have covered over the past few days is this national security issue. It all started with what we would call, I'd basically say, Article 10 or Subsection 10. Because Subsection 10, and I don't know what that boom is, but you're getting some feedback or something on your end, so... and it sounds kind of interesting on this side because I'm sure the listeners think I might have a little flatulence going or something. I don't know. Folks, it isn't me. I didn't do that.
It's my phone. My phone was...
Okay. All right. So, it's buzzing or something. Well, yeah. Anyway. So as we look at subsection, all Article 1, Section 8, we're still diving through the powers. These are enumerated powers. This is Congress's primary functions, and this is the power being granted to the government. This is what they're supposed to be doing. These are the objects of enumerations of powers. And so when we look at subsection 11, to raise and support armies, that's where it begins, and all of this is national security practically to the end. because when we get all the way through 11, 12 to provide and maintain a Navy, to make rules of governing and regulating lands of naval forces and so forth, that's 13, and then 14 to call forth the militia, 15 to provide for the organizing and disciplining, and then 16, where we kind of left off and we were covering this, is this starts off with the land grants, what the federal government is able to possess for property. Obviously, they need to possess the property where they're going to reside as a capital, as or a where they're going to function on the land. You're going to have the president sitting in one building. You're going to have the vice president maybe in another building or house, and then you'll have SCOTUS, and then you'll have the Congress, the representation of the people and representation of the states. Then you'll probably have some other ancillary buildings, because one of the things that they did when they instantly created the federal government, they created this office called the General Accounting Office. That office was designed to be able to go and be funded to buy pencils, to buy paper, to buy desks and chairs, and to actually be able to fund the facilities or the building of the facilities for the government. In other words, they need, and this goes into the Articles of Confederation, that they didn't have this. They did not have the ability to buy chairs or even to build a building. They were basically renters and they had no home. And so this is one of the reasons why creating a land, a place, would not be under the control of the state, where they had autonomy and they couldn't be harassed into behaving a certain way. This is why they had autonomy. They spell this out in the ratification base, because there were a lot of people there that didn't understand, why are you giving them this land? Why can't they just be within a state? Well, you know, we actually had these discussions and we identified the problems, and this is why. And so they laid this out of this, having this very particular land. And therefore, if they were going to have their own land, they needed to police it. The last thing they want to do is be dependent on a state to police them, because then that state would be empowered to harass them. So the whole point of this exclusive legislation that we dove into was literally to do that, to provide some form of governing, but never to become a state. This was an autonomous area where the federal government would function, and it was not to be a state, because if it became a state, then that state could harass the members of all the Congress and everybody else coming from other states. It was never to be a state. And so as we moved away from the Electoral College, and as we moved down this path, because technically nobody would be a citizen of the federal government, you had to be a citizen of the state. So in other words, the permanent residency never should have happened. They should never have allowed people to permanently live in the District of Columbia. It was to be a transient point for all people to come serve and then go home, you know, go back to Maryland, go back to Virginia. What ends up happening, though, is the people that start filling the jobs within the General Accounting Office and all these other little positions that they had to create, because they had to employ people. So the necessary and proper clause that we get into in the next one, which is the final subsection of Section 8. This is where all of a sudden they started going down the path of creating necessary contracts for employing people, right? They became an employer of only those people who were necessary and proper to do the functions that were required for them to do, like the General Accounting Office. So they needed to hire employees. Over time, as we kind of just go over this evolution of government into the 1960s and then the 70s, when they went to a voluntary military. When they went to a voluntary military, they actually changed their labor contracts so that you were basically granted these privileges based on this contract. And I'll give you an example. Yours truly, I joined the Marine Corps, And when I joined the Marine Corps, I was promised as a part of my contract, my labor agreement was that when I, if I did 20 years, I would be able to retire and have free medical and dental and other benefits. Well, over time, Congress said, no, we need to save money and so that we can put it in our pockets. So we're going to steal from, because we kind of already covered, right, that Congress was to receive compensation, not compensation for their time served, not benefits of health care, not benefits of anything else. If they were to receive any other emolument, they weren't employees. These were public servants that were there to represent the people. Therefore, they were allowed to be compensated for that time. But to become a
the state legislature, that's what they do.
Yes.
To compensate you for your gas and time, and that's it.
That's it. And so the Congress started making upon themselves this golden parachute. And where did they have to start shorting people? Let's not honor the contract that we created for all of these people who came into the military and actually was willing to give up their life. We're going to short them, but we're going to make sure that we are taken care of. And that is the most repugnant level of corruption. You know, that's an indictment of how our society has evolved into this corrupt state. Because when you can't honor the fundamental contracts and you start aggrandizing your own pay and those types of things that you have no authority to do. And so, in other words, you're taking care of yourself and you're stealing from others that you promised what they, you know, promised them these benefits, what have you. Then that's an indictment of the level of corruption we had obtained at that point. Go ahead. You were going to say something.
So are you saying 16 and 17...
So what I'm doing is I'm trying to kind of get the tone of diving into where we were. And so what we're looking at, because when you back up on Section 8 as a macro, right, we're looking at this in a macro view. And we started off with, for today, we kind of started off with subsection 11, to raise and support armies. This is when the national defense, in other words, their biggest job and responsibility, the reason why the federal government exists, is actually starts with 10, to declare war, then those things. So that's where the national security, the first nine, from 1 to 9, the first nine are basic little things like to make in uniform rules of, you know, naturalization and bankruptcy laws, right? To coin money. Those things right there are the basic functions of what they're going to be doing. But their major responsibility, you make no doubt about it, their number one job for the federal government is our national security, to secure and protect the sovereignty of the states and the sovereignty of the people, as well as to protect their lives and property. So in other words, when we kind of boil or distill this down, the reason, and this goes back to the fundamental reason why we the people institute government, is to protect life and private property. And I've said this before, under the guise of the Constitution, when they started talking about the property that we're going to go through in subsection 16, they basically realized that if the federal government could possess land for any purpose or any reason, then they could become very wealthy. And the goal of the federal government would then be become a massive landholder. And so what they did was they made sure that they enumerated the land that they were able to possess, which is kind of what we covered. So in other words, this federal government was not to be rich. It had a focus and job to make sure that the states maintained their sovereignty so that they could be rich, so that the people could be rich, not the federal government. The federal government wasn't to be the big dog in America. They were basically our security and ensuring that we, the states, could be the big dog. And they are the big dog based on the design because they're the parties to the compact. So as we look at this, go ahead. Are you ready?
If their number one job, well, one of their number one jobs is to protect life and property, wouldn't charging property taxes be going against that? Because then their property can be taken away.
Yes, absolutely. So if government has the ability to levy a tax or to basically garner a tax upon the people, they should never be allowed as far as tax on their property. Based on the spirit of why we institute government, they should never be able to take that property nor leverage it away from you. So in other words, it's one thing for you to pay a voluntary property tax. And you know what? Back in these days, they did. This goes to, you know, my Monday show, because I was waiting to get into this on my Friday show. On my Monday show that you probably missed is where I dove into, voting and being a stakeholder in government. In the original design, you couldn't vote unless you paid a poll tax. You had to be a property owner. They didn't just let anybody vote. In other words, you had to have skin in the game. If you were going to vote so that these people could tax you, you had to have something that they could tax, which was property. If you were just an inhabitant that had no land, you were not a land buyer, purchaser, owning land, then it's not that you couldn't be a citizen, you couldn't be a voting citizen. There were standards to those people who were allowed to vote. And that's why poll taxes were integral in the state government. And that's probably how the states basically required people. I mean, that's what you want to become a status of a citizen of the state. That means you're voting in the state, then you actually have to own property. So I went out, and so I'll dive into this more because I think it's really worth challenging people's paradigms to start understanding that we have to have consequences, you know, for people to behave properly. Because if all of a sudden somebody stands to lose, you know, like look at Bill Gates. Bill Gates is able to go out and buy land and wage economic warfare against the states by basically buying farmland and making it non-productive. How can the states not see that as economic warfare?
Yeah.
And so Bill Gates should actually be charged, and what he's doing in a grand scale of his involvement in foreign affairs, with foreign governments, with China, with the World Health Organization, this man is operating an insurrection against the United States. 100%. He should lose based on the Tory Acts, which you didn't get through with me, but based on the Tory Acts and the Constitution, and when we get into the 14th Amendment, we'll be able to define this. Bill Gates should be stripped of his property, all of his riches, and basically be kicked out of the United States and barred from ever being able to come into the United States or ever function as a U.S. citizen, period. Because that was that was the precedence created by the Tory Acts and our founders. When I say our founders, I'm talking about the original states. The states founded this nation, and they were not going to allow any loyalist of the enemy of liberty, which was Britain. They were not allowing them, any of these loyalists that were left behind, they were kicked out. They lost their property. They lost everything. The only thing that they were allowed to do, because they had decency laws, was to actually walk out of their homes clothed.
Right. So also the allowing of purchasing the property by the Chinese is also wrong.
Well, so there's nowhere here where they have the ability to own property or allow any foreign nation to buy property. And as a matter of fact, when we get into sections 9 and 10, you're going to realize that the states cannot even go into contracts with a foreign nation. They can't sign a treaty or have any formal legal engagement with a foreign entity, which this is, we already have the petition that we created. It's already done that stops the ability of any foreign entity from buying, holding, or being involved in any land, resource, or property within the United States.
Which one's that?
It is, I believe it is petition 20.
Okay.
Anyway, I sent it out. I thought you were on the distribution for that. So go look at the email.
I'm sure I have it.
Yes. So I'm just kind of waiting on any input. I'll be putting that up so that anybody can use that. And as a matter of fact, folks, if you're interested in getting these faster, then you need to get involved, because I do send these out to the group. You just need to be a part of the group that is working ardently in taking back our government. So now we're creating this macro view from basically subsection 10 down to subsection 17, finishing up section 8. This is why in subsection 16, one, the federal government was granted this small parcel of land to put buildings to operate. It was 10 acres. So anybody could easily reside in the state of Maryland. Anybody could easily reside in the state of Virginia to function and work within this said district and make it to work on a daily basis, you know, commuting on a horse or what have you. But bottom line, nobody should be living and residing in the federal seat, in this District of Columbia, except those people who have to be there for temporary purposes of a, what do you want to call it, a domicile, a temporary domicile. But if there are people that own land, as a matter of fact, no person should be able to buy a home in the District of Columbia. That's federal property. The value of the land in the federal government should have no value, because they're not to possess wealth in their value. Now, we all realize, and the framers realized this, when they were talking in the ratification debates, they understood that the essence of wealth is property. And property in its true form, in its liquid form, is basically bars of gold and silver. In other words, you can sell everything you own and then clothe yourself with golds of bar and silver, because you can have nothing left if you just have gold and silver bars and coins and what have you, and you have no other property. That means you're naked, and the only thing you have is gold and silver, because that means zero property, no clothes, no jewelry, just gold and silver. If you've completely liquidated a person's estate. Wow. So understanding that the essence of property in our paradigm, the gold and silver coin is your property. The government is only a steward of your property. In other words, it's their job to print it, make it available, and ensure and regulate its value so that you do not lose the value of your property.
Yeah. I don't want to go off on a tangent here, but
that's okay.
Have you ever done an episode about land patents and claiming your land patents?
Well, so I don't understand what a land patent is, other than it's something that went awry when the federal government and the state government started doing things. Because the bottom line is, you have a deed, you know, and a title to that land. When you buy that, whether you're getting financing from a bank or anything, they actually went down this path, and this is where the sovereign citizens and those folks, you know, are basically saying, hey, this is what you got to do. I'm telling you, folks, what they did and how they're doing it is not legitimate. Did you see anything in here where the federal government could actually possess and leverage your property? Not at all. The only property that they're delegated, now we'll dive into this. It says right here, because this is what you read, to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district, not exceeding 10 mile squares, and may, this is the kicker right here, and made by cession of particular states, the acceptance of Congress become the seat of government of the United States. So when we come back, I'll read the last half of this, because this is where they kind of spell it out. The federal government first has to purchase the property, and they can only possess the property for these very specific purposes. We'll be right back after this quick promo. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so getting this picture to be clear as mud, or as, you know, clearing the water as much as we possibly can, you can tell that the whole focus is national security, because when you look at the rest of the property first, federal government has to have property for them to do their job, for them to secure the nation and to guard us. And then look at the property that they're being given as we look at the last half of subsection 16. To exercise like authority, in other words, they're going to have exclusive legislation over all places purchased by the consent. In other words, they just can't come take your land. They have to get the consent, and they have to purchase that land or lease. And that's what they ended up doing, because they realized the military bases were not permanent, because as the territories, we kind of talked about this too, as they started moving west, they created forts and territories. And as the threats went away, then the need for having that fort for helping secure the people from an invasion from Mexico or what have you just became less and less, to where they move them towards more of the boundaries where the, you know, the international boundaries were, because the heartland of America shouldn't be threatened because nobody had bombers or anything like that. And so bottom line, when we look, these are the properties that they were granted to possess a little bit of land for. And so purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state, in which the same shall be for the erection of forts. So they have the authority to have land for forts or military installations, magazines, which are arsenals, which they say magazines, arsenals. It's the same. A magazine and an arsenal is stockyards or stockpiles of weapons, stockpiles of munitions, you know, places where they have their logistics supplies to do their warring, because sometimes that's on the fort, and then sometimes for national security, they need to have a lot of rounds. As this nation grew, they needed to make sure that we had enough rounds, like as the missiles and nuclear age, we started looking at the proliferation of missiles and so forth. So we're talking about large munitions and the ability to actually protect ourselves. Right, wrong, or indifferent, they have this huge responsibility of safeguarding our lives and our private property. So this military association was directly a part of that. And the dockyards was for the Navy bases. The Navy installations and dockyards served both the Navy as well as the importation, because if you look up, a part of this one unique power that they had was to regulate commerce coming in the states. They had this is their job, is to regulate all commerce coming in. They weren't to regulate or tax commerce going out, but and they could actually forbid certain commerce to going to certain nations if they were labeled as enemies and so forth. But the point is this, is that when we look at what they were given and granted here, it was very clear that this was for national security purposes and or for them to do their job. And so the final piece of property, the final piece of property was kind of what I mentioned earlier of the General Accounting Office and other needful buildings, because they needed to have a building for the General Accounting Office or whatever's necessary for them to function in maintaining our sovereignty and our protecting us. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Nowhere here do they have parks. You know, it's nice to have recreation. That's a state function, not the federal government. They're not to entertain us. There's no national coliseums, national museums, those types of things. It's one thing if the states wanted to do that, but there's no enumeration for national museums. So when we want to record those types of things, that onus is left to, and this is why many states have World War II museums, World War II, you know, or, you know, Civil War or what have you. They want to have these museums. That's great. That's what the state should do. The state should have the parks. They should have the history because it's their job to teach history. The federal government's job, as we already covered, their only job is to ensure that we, the people, the militia, understand the laws so that we can execute them and protect ourselves and defend ourselves, because that's how it was to be done. The federal government basically had this administrative function, and that we as a self-governing people had the ultimate execution of the laws and the ultimate defending of ourselves. So we actually had to have skin in our game. So this kind of goes back to what I was saying on Monday regarding elections, that, you know, if somebody is actually serving their country, I know that if you're out there, you know, getting an education and college education, and, you know, I think that anybody that's in school and education, anybody in school and education should have the afforded opportunity to focus on the disciplines of what they're doing. As a matter of fact, that's one of the things that they kind of help people understand, is to survive and to do what you need to do to perform well, you need to be able to focus on your education. I mean, many kids have to go through a formal, you know, basic introduction to, you know, higher education when they go to college. So they have to sit in this class so that they learn how to do time management, so that they understand that this is a huge commitment, that you don't get your money back if you drop out or if you, you know, you can't perform because you haven't made the commitment of the studying time and those types of things. Because this is self-education. You know, higher education is not where your teacher says, you know, we're going to grade you along and you got to go home and here's your homework and bring it back. I mean, you're no longer being compelled. This is something that you're kind of doing and you're a participant in. So I'm not the king. And I know the people that, you know, hear when I push paradigms, people usually push back and go, this is stupid because they've never heard these things before. But this is one of the things, and this was a paradigm of the framers. When they were in school, Madison finished his school, I think, when he was 16 years old, 17, when he graduated from Princeton. He went to Princeton at a very young age. And same thing with Thomas Jefferson. Many of these men had already had their degrees or their jurist or what have you by age 19. Because their years and their time, they were allowed to accelerate and focus, you know, because that was their focus at that point in time. This playing and socialization was not a part of their life. They lived very serious lives and they didn't have lots of distractions. You know, that was a good thing. You know, and a disciplined society should never have allowed us to go down this path of just, hey, let's expose everybody to everything. like they do today, especially in school today, where they're exposing kids to all sorts of harmful things. Anyway, back to this. So wrapping this all up, clearly in subsection 16 is where the federal government is allocated the very specific property. It enumerates the only property that they can possess. Even if the states came along and said, we're going to give you this huge thing called Yellowstone because it's out there in the Louisiana Territory. It's not even a territory to become a state. We're giving this to you so that you can create a national, you know, resource and so forth. There is no enumeration in this Constitution that grants them the power to create the national resource, national park, national anything. Unless it's enumerated, they can't do it. Therefore, that land, then when it gets incorporated into the state, it is up to the state to determine what it wants to do with that.
Right.
Period. Folks, we've been so bamboozled regarding what the government can do and what they can possess and everything else. This is why you don't have, you actually have mineral rights, but nobody recognizes it because the government says so. You actually own that land, but nobody recognizes it because this government has created this facade and, you know, a group of collusions between bankers and so forth have created this facade to say, you really don't. We're keeping it from you, when they don't have the authority to even do that. So when we actually start looking and going down the path of setting up these committees, these constitutional compliance committees at the county, this is all going to be exposed. And so what ends up having to happen, and I'm trying to work with a pretty smart lawyer, but he's not available right now, but I believe that we need to uncover what the process is, and I think it's very simple. That once you get enough counties in the state to actually take back their land, take back the law, and take back their government, and then say, we're taking back this state. And what we're going to do is we're going to create a constitution for this state, and we're going to undo that crap constitution that was rammed down our throats. And we're going to create a very limited and defined state government, and we're going to make sure that the massive power and the massive responsibilities of government are left with the county and closest to the people.
Mm-hmm.
And as we start moving forward, excuse me, so as we start moving forward, as this all kind of, the dots start to connect, what we'll end up doing is we'll start invoking most of these things at the state level. But we can't invoke things at the federal level until we have enough states to force the federal government into compliance, because we can't technically nullify. But what we can do is we can start putting the federal government on notice and say, you know, you're doing these things and we're coming.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, you know, one of the things we want to make sure is that you understand that everything that you've done, and as a matter of fact, here's the problem. There are millions, probably 2+ million people, maybe more, that are employed by the federal government that are doing jobs and functions that are not authorized for the federal government to do.
Right.
So there's going to be a massive layoff. And there's going to be a huge, I'll just say, crash in the D.C. housing market. And, you know, as we look at the entire United States over the course of the past 200 some years, there has never, folks, there has never, unless you have a documentation, I can't think of ever a time when there was a crash in the housing market of D.C. because it's constantly been growing and growing and growing. And it's becoming bigger and bigger and bigger. It's become the Babylon of the world. And so, or I should say, you know, one of the few Babylons, like the Vatican, the London, and other principal capitals around the world, Beijing. I mean, you know, there's this growth of Babylon throughout these different states. So the point is this, is that what we're going to do is we're actually going to help everybody transition into becoming a productive member of society instead of a, what we'll call a shill for destroying productivity, a shill for obscuring or hindering productivity. Because when you look at most all of the things that the federal government does, all it does is it creates burdens and or restrictions upon the states in keeping them from being able to unleash their resources. Now, it doesn't mean that when the states have this power and authority, it's upon the state to basically start managing itself, because it's repugnant to think that a state would allow, you know, a company to operate within it that's going to kill their people by dumping toxins into their water. We don't need the federal government to do that. But we do need this ability for the states to actually start working together and getting along. So as we dive into the very last subsection, I'll let you read 17.
Okay. To make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or officer thereof.
Okay, so this is that mystical clause that everybody says, well, we can do anything we want, because right there it says we can make all laws necessary and proper. Ah, but it's that yellow part, for carrying into execution the foregoing powers. Now, do you see any punctuation between the black letters and those following yellow letters in that stanza?
No.
There's no semicolon, there's no colon, there's no dash, there's no comma. In other words, that is all one word, or that's all one phrase, to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers. In other words, these enumerated powers. These are the enumerated powers. You've heard me say this right there. The Constitution says that. Anything else, and anything else within Article 1, anything else within Article 1, Section 1 through 7 and 8 and or 9 and 10, and Articles 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, there are really no enumerated powers other than some unique specified powers, such as the judiciary shall, you know, be the, you know, the supreme court over all the land, and they shall have jurisdiction over all laws arising under this Constitution. In other words, they, when we dive into Article 3, we're going to show you that their jurisdiction can only be over these things arising under this Constitution. So when we talk about healthcare, when we talk about the climate, CO2, when we talk about abortion, does that arise under this Constitution? How about food? Does food arise and the growth of food? No. Now, they can talk about taxes, direct taxes on income, but they can't use that to create a hole to, you know, breach through the Constitution to start going in and saying, you know, we're going to start creating laws of how you're growing food, how you're, you know, spending your money, and so forth. No, they have the ability to tax. There's no implication that they can start creating laws and regulations and start basically worming their way into every facet of our lives. That's why it says they have jurisdiction for all things arising under this Constitution and all things within their enumerated authority. In other words, if they can make a treaty, then that treaty can become the supreme law of the land. We'll get into this in the supremacy clause, but they do not have the authority to make a treaty if it's not within their enumerated powers. In other words, what you're seeing right here is where they have the enumerated powers, and there's nowhere here where they have the ability to affect any state land other than to purchase it for these very specific purposes. So there's nowhere where they're granted the ability to create or buy or even affect the sale of state land. Nowhere in the Constitution do they have these delegated authorities. So as we dive into the next section, I just want to kind of do the precursor for this in Section 9. And what I could do, because Section 9 is just an enumeration of restrictions, and Section 10 is also an enumeration of restrictions. I should actually, when you look at this, it would be easier if I injected sub-paragraphs, or I should say subsections. That way we can actually, you know, call it by subsection 1, subsection 2, because the reason we do that with the powers is to be very specific so that everybody's on the same path. But I think there's merit in doing it, and I'll do it down the road. But as we dive into subsection, or I should say Article 1, Section 9, the very first paragraph, the very first stanza is a restriction placed upon the federal government that they cannot inhibit the state's ability for the importation of persons. Okay, so, but nowhere here do we see in this stanza or anywhere else in the Constitution where the federal government has any authority of the importation of persons. And what I mean by that is importing a lot of people, mass people, just going to Syria and grabbing a bunch of people as refugees and moving them to America. The only place that this is mentioned is here, where a state could actually go and bring in a bunch of people, not immigrating them, importation, where they bring in slaves. And this was all about slavery. Everybody else that was brought into America was literally one by one immigrants. The thought of importing people was considered a slave trade. This is why, this is how they worded this. And so down the road, why would anybody import a group of people other than to serve a function, whether it be a labor force or some other force to do something maniacal, like bringing in refugees so that they could actually create an autonomous zone, create a small state within a state. Go look at Dearborn, Michigan, where Mohammedans have actually created a state within Michigan, where they basically have created a place of Sharia law. Where, and there's other places in America where you can't buy pork because they've made it illegal. And near as I can tell, that in essence is a direct violation of the U.S. Constitution, allowing another group of people to create their own state within a state. States do not have that authority, nor does the federal government have that authority.
Right.
Okay, so go ahead and let's start off with Section 9, this very first clause.
The mitigation or importation
migration.
Of such
the
persons.
The migration.
Oh, sorry. The migration. The migration or importation of such persons as any of the states now existing shall think proper to admit shall not be prohibited by the Congress prior to the year 1808. But a tax or duty may be imposed on such importation, not exceeding $10 for each person.
Okay, so in other words, they're going to allow, because the South said we have to import a bunch of slaves because we lost them in the Revolutionary War. They emancipated a bunch of slaves. So what ended up happening, and the promise that was granted, these slaves, these blacks that became freemen, if they went and fought for liberty, they would become freemen and citizens. Now, down the road, they started recanting. They started taking back those types of promises. And so eventually, by the early 1800s, many states started rejecting the ability of freemen to actually vote. In New York State, a freeman was able to vote for the ratification of the Constitution. A freeman was able to vote in elections until early 1800s. And this became a movement based on Hamilton and the lawyers. They actually started creating a movement in response to abolition, that as they started creating this diametrically opposing philosophy from the North and the South, they actually started incorporating that diametrically philosophy, this opposing philosophy within every state. They, in other words, they started oppressing blacks in the abolition states. Why would they do that? Why would they start creating laws that would be oppressive? Because they were trying to institutionalize biases and started to create biases, even though, you know, the people in the North were basically, you know, we want people to be free. Well, they started indoctrinating or inculcating them and teaching them that having biases, that they, you know, making people believe that there's these differences, that they're uneducated, they're incapable of having the same intelligence, thinking, and so forth, and so we don't want them voting. They started actually creating these stereotypes, false stereotypes, by the way, false stereotypes. So what they ended up doing was they started institutionalizing racism. And I want to be clear that the entity or the driving force in the northern states was the lawyers, these groups of people that were getting their bar associations or getting their training from the British Accredited Registry of Law. Now, the bar, as a matter of fact, will even point out that down the road, as the federal government started recognizing this in 1812, or actually I think it's 1809, they created an amendment to the Constitution. We're going to dive into that. But I'm just trying to wrap up today so that we are very, very clear that this was kind of creating an end to slavery, but it was also a beginning of how the states started embracing racism, not on their own, but as it was being led by the legal system. Because the legal system started creating these advantages for whites and started creating, oh, well, you know, anybody, you give people something, you create an entitlement, then all of a sudden it starts growing. And this was where we really started destroying ourselves as a nation. We really started, instead of embracing one discipline and enlightenment and the concept of everybody, helping everybody learn and helping everybody have equal understanding, reasonable people, equally informed, seldom disagree. And having an enlightened society to where we can all almost think and decide as one simultaneously, because we've done that. We all, because that's how the framers were. When they started creating this nation, they were equally informed. And they put aside their differences and their self-interest. That's discipline. They disciplined themselves to get, you basically create this union that allowed a dichotomy, or this, I'll just say, allowed these disparate paradigms to exist. A free market of religion, a free market of labor, a free, well, for the most part, other than the southern states wanted slavery. So anyway, as we, you know, wrap this up, we're just starting off with section 9, subsection 1 of section 9, but anyway, thank you so much, Tammy, for joining us and going through this. And, you know, we'll actually start going through the rest of the restrictions and start moving forward probably at a faster clip as we move, you know, as we go into the rest of the Constitution. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.